welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tarpley, here in Washington, D.C. And this has been a busy week for me. Last week I was on the Mancow Muller show, big syndicated AM morning program coming from Chicago, to discuss my new book, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. This past week now, I was lucky enough to give an interview, an 11-minute RT interview to Russia Today. This was an interview done by Alyona Minkowski, the Russian Today correspondent here in Washington, D.C. That aired on the 23rd of June, but you can find a tape of that, which is on YouTube. I suppose if you put in Tarpley Minkowski, M-I-N-K-O-V-S-K-Y, you will find it. And I'd like to thank Alex Jones for having me on his program yesterday, that is to say Thursday, the of this week. Some other radio also in the works, and this often revolved around the Obama questions, but also around economic policy. Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis in Human History. We're going to do a segment later on the question of the bank holiday of 1933 and the rumors spread by some newsletters that there's going to be another bank holiday. Let me just tell you, I don't think a bank holiday right now is in the offing. I think Obama's doing everything possible to prevent the shutdown of the big zombie banks, the 16 out of the 19 top money center banks that are bankrupt. And they're bankrupt, of course, because of derivatives. And the goal, of course, of the Obama administration, the overriding policy goal, is to prop up the $1.5 quadrillion derivatives bubble at all costs. That is the goal of this administration. Everything else is sacrificed to that, be it foreclosures, health care, the environment, whatever you want to call it. So that's coming up later on. Let's now, however, rush right to Iran. We see that the CIA color revolution, people power coup, the Velvet Revolution planned by the various centers of imperialist interference and meddling seems to be breaking down. Too early to give a final verdict on this, but it has not taken off in the way that some of these have. This is looking more like the abortive Cedars Revolution in Lebanon, where you had the rich golden youth of Beirut, right? The golden youth of the wealthy families of the Christian Maronite community came out in their BMWs and Mercedes-Benz, if not Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and Maseratis, to tell the Western correspondents how much they were hurting. In that case, the organized power of Hezbollah was instrumental in defeating them. This one looks like it's going the same way, because the golden youth, the rich elitists of North Tehran, the desperate housewives of North Tehran, and the swarming adolescents, rent-a-mobs and dupa mobs, recruited from the University of Tehran and other universities. The only action they've been able to show in other cities, you know, they show you Shiraz, they show you Isfahan, and if there's anything at all, it's just some students. And this is not enough, as we've seen repeatedly over the past 40 years. So this entire pattern seems to be inadequate, and it seems to be failing. There's also now the question of reality necessarily coming back in, despite the best efforts of the Anglo-American media whores who are trying to sell this. It looks like the coup is not going to go over. We've had this very interesting attempt by the Anglo-American media to do what they always try to do, which is to put a face on this, right? The sort of little people approach. You'll remember the incubators of Kuwait, right? The Iraqi army accused of tearing babies out of the incubators in Kuwait City. And remember her, that witness in the Congress turned out to be the daughter, or was it the niece, of the Kuwaiti ambassador. She was a complete shill and plant. Then we've had the question of Jessica Lynch, her story that was used to popularize the first attack on Iraq in 2003. That turned out to be a tissue of lies. And now we have the story of an unfortunate young woman by the name of Nida in Iran. This has been taken up now by the Twitterized Wall Street-controlled media from CNN to MSNBC to the BBC, of course, the BBC leading the charge, the BBC Persian television service. For the first time, the BBC has mounted a television service in the Persian language, Iranian Farsi, which has been inaugurated just a couple of months before these abortive riots and mob rule events in Iran. There is no Iranian ambassador to the U.S. It's hard for the Iranians to counter some of these arguments because they have no ambassador in Washington. They do have an ambassador at the United Nations, but in this case, it's the Iran ambassador to Mexico who has spoken up, and he's essentially said, well, this might have been a provocation by the CIA. You send in some provocateurs, right, in this case maybe a sniper, dressed up as an Iranian Revolutionary Guard or dressed up as a Basij militiaman or a black-clad riot policeman, and then you kill somebody. And then you make that into a media event. This argument is absolutely plausible. There's nothing scandalous or outrageous about that. My God, haven't we been through the entire 9/11 debate and these other examples that I've just given? So that's certainly possible. And the Iranian ambassador to Mexico, you can find this on CNN. He was interviewed by a horrified Wolf Blitzer who couldn't believe that anyone would think that the CIA would ever do such a thing. And this, of course, is just crazy. You can see that he also says that the goal is to destabilize the regime. And he also accuses the CIA of fomenting the other nationalities. And we've talked about this repeatedly on this program because it's not just Persians, Iranians in there. You've got Kurds. You've got Arabs. You've got Azeris. You've got Pashtuns. You've got Baluchis. You've got some others in Iran, the various ethnic groups. And we've shown various times, tried to describe anyway, the six-way partition of Iran, which is planned, leaving just that landlocked, no oil Iranistan in the middle. In particular, we've talked about the Arabistan, the Ahvaz Liberation Front, or the BP, British Petroleum Liberation Front, the desire to detach the oil province along the, what can we say, the northwest, well, hard to describe this, but the Iranian coast along the Gulf, along the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf, as you want to call it. That is the Karg Island oil refinery, the Karg Island tanker terminal, the Abadan refinery, and various oil fields. And the British have got an active group of terrorists in there who are blowing people up left and right. Some very spectacular attacks and some very spectacular hangings that have been done later on by the Iranian regime. None of this, of course, means that you're endorsing Ahmadinejad, but the general rule here is don't interfere in the internal affairs of sovereign states. That used to be called the good neighbor policy. That was Roosevelt's policy towards Latin America. If it had not been for the good neighbor policy, you would have had a whole lot more pro-Nazi and pro-fascist action going on in Latin America. That might have turned into a whole new front in the Second World War. The fact that it did not was due to the forbearance of Roosevelt and some others. Don't go in there. Don't do it. And again, here, if you want to stay out of big, big trouble, stop meddling and interfering in the internal affairs of sovereign states. We'll have a couple of words more about Iran and then rush on to other topics when we return.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Notice that Iran has been getting very important support from Russia. Ironically, the goal of the Color Revolution People Power coup mounted by the Anglo-American intelligence services in Iran is to put in a new regime under this rather checkered character, Mousavi. You could make a case that he's the biggest mass murderer. He's done far more crimes than Ahmadinejad ever did, as far as we can see. Although maybe that wouldn't hold up under further analysis. But in any case, the goal there, of course, is to get Iran working against China, right? A new regime put in under these circumstances would very soon cut off all oil deliveries to China. I guarantee you. Because that's the goal. That's the idea. To kick the Chinese out of Africa, out of the Middle East, to cut off the Chinese oil, to cut off the Chinese access to critical raw materials from Africa, from places like Zimbabwe. And anybody who deals with China becomes immediately a human rights violator in the Anglo-American lexicon. So that is the goal. But now what the effect of this is, the abortive and possibly failed color revolution, has driven the Iranians closer to Russia. It has made it much more difficult to get any conflict going there in that critical Caspian Sea region, right? The conflict across the Caspian Sea, which would be the goal of the U.S. Establishment, the soft power group around Joseph Nye, the aggressive faction of the New American Foundation, because they have now split, as we find, and in general terms, the Brzezinski Rand Corporation group, otherwise typified by the late Samuel Huntington. So very early on in the crisis, you saw Ahmadinejad going to a meeting of the Shanghai Cooperation Group, meeting with Medvedev, the president of Russia, and so forth. So the Russians are also mounting a critique of color revolutions in general. That is useful. By the way, if you go to the search engines on the Internet and you find you look for postmodern coup, the first thing you'll find is Obama, the postmodern coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate, the book that some other authors and I put together very early on in the 2008 primary campaign. So get your copy of Obama, the postmodern coup from Amazon or from progressivepress.com. The question of the CIA interference is beyond all doubt. Many sources have now referred to a public signing ceremony or executive order by Bush, that's Mad Dog Bush the Younger, in May of 2007, in which Mad Dog Bush the Younger announced with great fanfare and great triumphalism a $400 million project to overthrow the Iranian regime using the obvious materials, that is the social networking sites, the various kinds of media, the notion of the satellite phones, of cell phones, texting, and all the rest of it. There have been repeated acts passed by Congress, Iran regime change, right? There have been all of these things. There was a big controversy during the 2007 primaries that Mrs. Clinton had voted for one of these things. You remember, the U.S. Congress is constantly meddling and interfering. And even worse than this, go back to Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker, starting, according to my count, in 2005. Seymour Hersh has been writing articles in the New Yorker about the presence of U.S. special forces and CIA teams inside Iran for the purpose, as he wrote, of preparing the battlefield. The question with Seymour Hersh is that he was getting these leaks, as he always does, from inside the Pentagon and other agencies, that there were these teams inside Iran. And he naturally interpreted this in the framework of preparing for a military strike on Iran, which at that time was still highly likely. You still had Cheney doing everything possible to get that going. Now I think we can see that preparing the battlefield can mean many things. It can mean preparation for an actual military strike with air attacks and some special forces teams being parachuted in to go into the underground bunker system and blow up the things you can't reach even with bunker buster bombs, or can't do that efficiently. But now there's also this other question, as the Iranian ambassador to Mexico reminds us, the fomenting of the Kurds, the fomenting of the Arabs, the Azeris, the Pashtuns, and the Baluchis through organizations like Jundallah, CIA MI6-backed organization there fomenting rebellion and terrorism among the Baluchis. There was a big bomb that went off during the election campaign in one of the main cities of Baluchistan. You've got this Ahvaz Liberation Front, BP Liberation Front, as we call it. They were very big in their mobilization in previous years. And then you got this MEK, the Mujahideen-e Khalq, which is an army with tanks and all kinds of heavy weapons, which are being preserved under U.S. government sponsorship. They are untouchable. They are sitting on Iraqi territory, but the hands-off sign is put there by the U.S., and they're being held ready for God knows what kind of an intervention. So the massive, systematic acts of war, violations of international law, meddling in the internal affairs of Iran is beyond all doubt. This does not depend on what Obama says from one minute to the next, whether he uses this rhetoric or that rhetoric. This is institutionalized. You've got this radio Farda, right? Farda television that goes in from the U.S. side, the Voice of America, and then, of course, the flagship, the BBC Persian service, the BBC Iranian service. So all of this mechanism, and it appears to be not working, although this regime is certainly shaken. It looks more like the Cedars of Lebanon, or indeed a mild version of Tiananmen, all very similar effects. Doesn't look like the Ukrainian Orange Revolution of November 2004, which brought Europe to the brink of possible war if civil war had broken out in the Ukraine and Russian troops had intervened on one side and Polish and other NATO on the other. That's where you see World War III in sight very, very quickly. Nor does it look like the Roses Revolution in Georgia, which installed the fascist madman Saakashvili, who showed his lunacy last August by and undertaking a solo attack on the Russian superpower. Not wise. It's interesting. There is a real movement in Georgia of all kinds of people, many of whom I don't endorse, but for sure, there is a process of demonstrations and contestation and agitation by the opposition in Georgia against Saakashvili. They have done all of the tactics really that they've learned from Saakashvili as he took power. They've been trying to use them against Saakashvili. Do they get any support in the Anglo-American media? They're fighting for liberty against a guy who is clearly an aggressor and a dictator and a madman. And he's disappearing people. He's beating people up and killing people the whole time. You can see that on Russia Today. They're the only ones who will show it to you. The Anglo-American media completely ignores this. I'm reminded of the notion by Jacques Sapir, S-A-P-I-R, the French economist, who says that the entire Western rhetoric of human rights is completely discredited because it is used with such cynical hypocrisy and double standards to justify imperialist intervention. We'll be back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. D.C. This is what lies behind the statement by Khamenei, the top Ayatollah of Iran, that the British, Perfide Albion, have been massively interfering in Iran. This is demonstrable based on the public laws. Of the United States, and then the British do it in a different way. But the U.S. profile couldn't be more clear. And indeed, you can get these congressmen to pop off. They'll tell you, they'll boast about how much they're interfering in Iran. Regime change. That's what they want. So there we go. And the hypocrisy is so intense that the entire rhetoric of human rights is completely discredited, because this is used in a very one-sided way to attack the enemies of imperialism. And, of course, when you get the human rights violations of a Saakashvili or whoever is ruling Uganda for the British or whatever that is, then there you get complete silence. So that bears watching, however. It is very, very dangerous to try to overthrow the government of a fairly substantial power like this. Although we don't want to participate in this rhetoric that always creeps in that Iran is some kind of superpower and so on. Iran is economically not in good shape. This, of course, another theme of hypocrisy. The same commentators on CNN who are telling you what a failure Ahmadinejad is in the economy, forget to remind you that there are economic sanctions demanded by the U.S. and the British that are strangling and crippling the Iranian economy. So you can't blame all of that on the regime. The other thing is, how might Iran strike back? I think you can see it. The obvious thing to do is to heat things up in Iraq, and here the United States will pay a price. The notion that the surge in Iraq ever worked is absurd. What worked was, it seems to me, some kind of dire threat delivered to Iran saying, you cool down Iraq or we will strike you. And the Iranians at that point, I think, said, well, fine, we'll cool down Iraq. And they have done so. But with this latest barrage, the U.S. has broken that commitment to the Iranians, who have now jacked up all kinds of bombings and all kinds of activities in Iraq. And that's just a hint of what they could do. If they ordered, again, the Mahdi army of Muqtada Sadr and other people to start cutting the U.S. supply lines, to start, you know, going wild with RPGs and machine guns along that route Tampa down there in southern Iraq between Kuwait City and Baghdad, generally speaking, that could play hob, cause mayhem in the entire U.S. position. There's also a lot the Iranians can do in Afghanistan. Why get into this? The recrudescence, the upswing, the return of the Iraq war is definitely possible. This would be a huge, huge problem for the U.S. And at the same time in Afghanistan, that's already going about as badly as possible. So, this kind of meddling, not a good idea, and geopolitically it's backfiring, because if Iran moves in friendship to the Russians, this is the worst of all possible outcomes from the point of view of the U.S. Imperialist mindbenders. Now, we've got some further economic statistics. According to the United Nations, there are now 1 billion people in the world who are hungry and in danger of starvation. Their food situation is extremely tenuous. 1 billion, one-sixth of humanity, approximately. What kind of commentary is that on the joys of globalization, as has been sold by all kinds of people, from Soros to the Clinton administration to the current Summers, Geithner, Bernanke crowd here in Washington? The U.S. unemployment is now 9.4% official, meaning 20 to 25% in reality. California, 11.5% unemployment. That seems to be the highest. Industrial unemployment, extremely high. U.S. industrial production continues to fall at a rate of about 1% per reporting period. The average still remains 500,000 jobs lost per month. We've also got, to sum it up, 10% of the U.S. population on food stamps. That's 33 million plus. Well, so it's more than 10%. And about 10% of all mortgages are now in arrears, meaning headed towards foreclosure if nothing else changes. Urgent intervention is needed. Don't tell those people about the free market. They will not be pleased, and so rightly so. Time to ban foreclosures. Time to gear up food stamps so people don't die. Stop talking about the Austrian school and the nanny state. Go tell some guy on a breadline about the horrors of the nanny state. He'll spit in your eye at the minimum. And remember also then that these unemployment benefits have also got to be kept up. But that's only in the interim before we can get a recovery going, because the duty of everybody is, when you see a depression, you fight it. You don't roll over and say, oh, that's just the Austrian school business cycle working, and if we wait a while, it'll go away. Yeah, how many have to succumb and die and have their lives ruined in the meantime? So no to the Austrian school, but also no to Obama. Let's get to the no to Obama right now. In the Congress, in the House of Representatives today, we've got this monstrous cap-and-trade operation going on, and this deserves to be opposed. The idea here is that under the cover of the lunatic Al Gore theory of anthropogenic global warming, that is, global warming created by human activity, a fraud, the guy's a charlatan, it's anti-scientific, it's irrationalism, it is a document of cultural pessimism and not of science. It's validated, of course, by a whole tribe of so-called climatologists. What kind of a specialty is that, right? Are you a meteorologist? Are you an astronomer, a geologist, an oceanographer? No, I'm a climatologist, meaning I've got a fake specialization in a specialty which has been created deliberately and exclusively to parrot support for this Malthusian idea, which is, of course, the fruit of the British oligarchy and their minions in the U.S. This is typified by Prince Charles's personal domination over Al Gore, Prince Charles being the ego ideal of Al Gore. So the idea is that you will have the levels of carbon emissions. Carbon is CO2 and carbon in general identified as a pollutant, which it's not. It's actually quite necessary for the biosphere that we have. Not a pollutant at all. That will be capped, and if you want to go beyond the caps, then you've got to trade these permits, these offsets. Now, what's going to happen with that? You can see it coming already. A speculative market, a speculative bubble in the carbon offsets will inevitably result. You can turn on CNBC or Fox Business News any day and see that the Wall Street gang thinks of nothing but the creation of new and bigger and better bubbles, even as their 1.5 quadrillion derivatives bubble collapses around their ears. They're trying to find new ways to start new bubbles. Now, we're seeing it, right? When we look at the London ICE exchange, right, the Intercontinental Exchange in London, we have followed on this program how during the summer of last year, 2008, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley bid up the price of oil on that London ICE exchange to the point where if you were paying $5 a gallon for gasoline in the summer of 2008, as the price peaked, you were paying $1 just to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley together. Now imagine what's going to happen when you've got to have these tradable, speculatable, and derivatable permits. You're going to have a huge speculative boom in those things, and that is going to be then a direct tax on production. Back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley here in Washington. I'd like to call your attention briefly to my book, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History. The long-awaited second edition is available from Amazon.com and from ProgressivePress.com. Please order multiple copies of Surviving the Cataclysm. We're going to illustrate one of the chapters later on in the program. Also, Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate. If you want to know what a color revolution is, a CIA people power coup, or Velvet Revolution, you can do no better than to get that book and read it. A distinguished essay in there by Jonathan Mawat on the color revolutions and how the Obama campaign itself borrowed so many of the elements of the color revolution, the telegenic demagogue. That seems to be one of the places where the Iranian coup has fallen down. And generally speaking, the people power coup only works if there's no organized opposition. We've seen that repeatedly. Some place like Lebanon, where you have a big Hezbollah organization fighting you, the thing becomes much harder. Similarly, today in Iran, You've also got Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography. Today we've got, if you look at the American Thinker, a right-wing website, we've got an essay by a lady of Nigerian background, L.E. Echinga, of a Nigerian background living here in the United States. And she goes through the cultural identity of Obama as a feature of post-colonial British colonies in Africa and Obama's obsession with his father. This is all fine, except when she gets to the point of saying Obama embraced Marxism. Obama never embraced Marxism. What he embraced is Frantz Fanon, which is not Marx. It is much worse, absolutely much worse. That is to say, Frantz Fanon, a follower of Nietzsche and Sorel, of purgative violence, big influence on Mussolini, but Fanon goes back to Nietzsche, to Sorel, and he preaches the idea that anti-colonial struggle has to be accompanied by as much violence as possible because the civilization of Europe and even more of the United States is demonic. This is worse than Marxism. Obviously, the Communist Party of the U.S., very poor theoretical development, was eager to cater, to opportunistically pander to this kind of Fanon stuff. And again, the ideology of Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn, they are Obama's best friends. If you asked Obama, who's your best friend, the honest answer would be Bill Ayers. This is what they preach. You can see their latest book, Race Course, where they give a kind of watered-down version of Fanon. The Weatherman SDS ideology of Ayers and Dorn is there has to be a race war in which much of the U.S. will be destroyed but will come out of it purged, finally, of the original sins of racism and slavery. This is a bad, bad scene. So don't call Obama a Marxist. You're helping him with that. Marxism does not pack the punch that it used to. That accusation would have been fairly effective in the 1950s, maybe into the 60s, but that's long gone. So forget about Obama as a Marxist. He is a Fanonist third world acolyte. He's a weatherman. His ideology is that of the weatherman. In other words, as some have mentioned, Obama is Bill Ayers. Yes, in the White House. A weatherman in the White House, an unbelievable situation. But to call that Marxism leads you in precisely the wrong direction. You can read all about this in Obama, the unauthorized biography. So those three at the moment. I'd also like to recommend for people the Obama deception. Alex Jones yesterday gave a report on his program about the tremendous progress of the Obama deception. 15, 20 million views, certainly translated into a dozen languages, including the big ones, right? The Chinese, Japanese, Spanish, German, French, Italian, Russian, Arabic, I think. It's available virtually to vast majority of the population of the world can now look at this. So get your copy of the Obama Deception. I have a humble contribution to this. And let's not forget Larry Sinclair. Larry Sinclair's book about Obama entitled Sex, Lies, Cocaine, and Murder. You can get Larry Sinclair's book from Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order it there, or maybe that has switched over into direct order. Now let's go back to cap and trade. This is nothing short of national suicide. Remember, the problem in a depression is that you got too much paper capital. You got too many fictitious claims on the income from production, and you got way too little production in terms of capital goods production, in industrial investment in particular. The U.S., as we've noted, is now below 10 million productive workers in factories. So this is the problem we have. Now, what does the cap and trade do? It makes it worse. It's exactly the opposite of what we should be doing, because on the one side, it creates a speculative market in these carbon offsets where the hedge funds and the Goldman Sachs of the world will go in and drive up those prices in a speculative manner, imposing an unlimited, theoretically unlimited tax on real production. There's some talk coming from the supporters of this bill, the bill in question, H.R. 2454, that's the one you've got to stop. HR2454. Call in right now. Tell them, stop it. No. No way. Nix. Don't do it. Pull back from this. This is the leap into the abyss. It imposes a tax on real production. It won't affect, Wall Street banks because their carbon footprint is minimal. But anybody who's producing anything will get slammed, and there's no limit to the amount of slam. There's also no limit to the amount that you as an individual will pay for heating oil, for gasoline, for your car, for kerosene, for propane, any other uses you have. All of that is going to get slammed. And again, there's no limit. It's not that the government is going to say, you know, you pay 15%. It's that this is now delivered into the hands of a speculative market where they can bid it up, doing to these carbon offsets what Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and a phalanx of hedge funds did to the price of oil during 2008. This is Al Gore. This is Malthus. Malthus, of course, a plagiarist of Jean Maria Ortes. And it's the it's the race science of our time. The idea of global warming, as Obama said the other day, the debate is over. The debate is not over. The debate is lively. The debate is increasing because the discrediting of the charlatans of climatology who have been created in particular to sell this particular piece of obscurantism and irrationalism, these people are on the defensive. As it becomes more and more clear that it is solar activity which is at work here, right? The parallels to events on other planets in the solar system where similar temperature rises are observed. And then my specialty, the historical argument, of course, is that we're well within the band of oscillation that we've seen with written records. Now, written records over the past 1,000 years, if you go from the period of the medieval warm period, 1000 AD, 1100 AD, Eric the Red, Leif Erikson, you know the drill, Vineland, grapes growing in Newfoundland, grapes growing perhaps in Iceland, grapes growing in Norway. We haven't seen that yet, but that was then, and it's obvious that the polar bears somehow made it through the medieval warm period. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any polar bears, would there? And then contrast that to the little ice age that we saw in the 1600s, the 17th century, when these icebergs came down and clogged the mouths of the rivers like the Rhine or the Elbe, and the other rivers of northern Europe were packed with not just frozen, but with icebergs sticking in their craw. So we're within the band of oscillation. What does it represent, therefore? It is a hysteria of the Anglo-American ruling elite with their typical Malthusian philosophy, Malthus being, of course, the father of Keynes. Conceptually speaking, Malthus being the leading ideologue of the British Empire in the 19th century, Malthus being the theoretician who basically told William Pitt the Younger, it's okay, go ahead and let those paupers die. That was the purpose of Malthus's essay. And again, he was a plagiarist. He had no original ideas. Everything he wrote came from the work of Gian Maria Ortes, O-R-T-E-S, of Venice. Look him up. There's an essay by me on the internet about Ortes. We'll be back in a minute.